Day, October 3rd, we have a couple of excuse absences, Representative Shadow House and Representative Lisa Kamiara in Washington, D.C., who went to the meeting, so we will wish them all the best and continue on for today on our agenda. First of all, since we do have a quorum, do we have a motion on our minutes from our last meeting in August, August 3rd? Commissioner Wallace.
I motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you. Motion before you to approve the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Let's go to our first item on the agenda then. We welcome Representative Ward to our group. And your family planning and contraception bill, we'll just turn the time over to you. If you have the presentation, if someone could email that to Shelly, then we can put it on our website. What is the anticipation? Will the technology work? Will it see some little flickers?
That's what I'm saying.
There we go. Perfect. Hey, go ahead.
I'm Ray Ward, and I'm here to present the family planning waiver that will be running in the next stage. I'm here with Dr. Dave Schrock and Dr. Jessica Sanders, who will help me with the presentation. For my technical expertise, I will be using a half sheet of paper with some scroll notes that I alone might be able to read. So this waiver, I'm going to give a brief introduction and then turn the time over to them. Would basically allow family planning services to be covered for individuals below the poverty level who currently don't have Medicaid. So everybody in that gap would get these services. So instead of trying to cover just a set number of people with a broad amount of services, it would cover everybody in that gap, but with this very limited but very important set of services. I think we've learned in Utah, maybe to our sorrow, that there are drawbacks to proposing things that have never been done before to the federal government. We've tried with our waiver for the homeless and those with substance abuse, and you know, here we are, well over a year and a half in with both the Democratic and Republican administration, who so far haven't even bothered to give us an answer. This particular waiver is a pre-approved waiver, so to speak. CMS has already gone through and said, this particular waiver, if you want that, you can have it. So we're going down a tried and true path, not any sort of an experimental path. It has a lot of things going for it. It is a 90-10 federal match that pre-dates Obamacare. That does not have to do with the Affordable Care Act. So it's a separate thing that doesn't stand or fall if Obamacare is repealed in the place. So every $1 we put in will generate $9 of our own tax dollars that come back to us to help fund this. And the way we've tried to define it, because you can define the service in different ways, is just to say if it's a family planning service that Medicaid would already cover, then this waiver would cover it. The most important part of it is a high quality, highly reliable birth control. And it's something that a woman just knows is going to work so that she can plan when she wants to have her children. This was in the governor's budget proposal last year, and we hope that it will be in his proposal again this year. I've said it before, but it's worth saying again, it does not cover a portion of that explicit in the bill language. The bill language is public that you can go look at. We're still waiting a fiscal note, but overall we expect the fiscal note would be similar to what it was last year, which is around $1 million per year. So with that introduction, I'll turn the time first to Dr. Turok and then he's done to Dr. Sanderson.
Committee members, senators, representatives, I'd like to express my gratitude for your willingness to discuss Utah Family Planning Services today.
Dr. Can you just introduce yourself?
Yes.
Your name and I'm coming. I jumped the gun.
My name is David Turok, and I've spent the last 20 years as an OBGYN physician in this community devoted to providing the best care possible to women with the fewest resources. And nearly all of the 1,000 babies I've delivered were born to mothers living below the federal poverty line. And they struggled mightily to take the best care of themselves and their families. But all too often, these pregnancies came at times when families were not ready to care for a child, and they were more likely to involve complicated medical and social issues. Problems like preterm birth and prolonged newborn intensive care unit stays, which are emotionally trying and very costly. Every day, I would encounter people who wanted to use the most effective and reversible methods of contraception. These are set-it and forget-it methods that can be placed on one visit and last for many years, and there are IUDs and implants. And they're more than 20 times more effective than the commonly used birth control pill. But they're also the most costly. And why myself and many colleagues try, we knew every day when we were walking out of clinics in Salt Lake County without the contraception they wanted simply because they couldn't afford it. So we spent some serious effort preparing for a test where we could fix this for 1 year and provide any woman in Salt Lake County with any method of contraception she wanted without cost. This program is called the Her Salt Lake Contraceptive Initiative. And over the past year, we provided 7,000 women with this service. 2,500 of them selected these most effective methods, the IUD or the implant. What's really exciting now is that we're able to follow these women and look at the difference in educational attainment and economic progress, and also savings to the state Medicaid program. These are all issues that I imagine are of vital import to this committee and commission. No matter what your most pressing issue is regarding women and families in the state, this makes it better. It makes more opportunity and more access and better outcomes for women and their families. So it's a win for women in the state, it's a win for families, and it's a win for the state. So we're here to talk to you today about what you can do to advance the state Medicaid program to cover contraception, and it's based on simple math. Currently, the Medicaid program covers prenatal care, births, and newborn care for women at below 138% of the federal poverty level. For each of those births, the cost is $12,000. Much more if there's complications. But for almost all of these women, before they're not covered by services, and they have to figure out how to pay for contraception on their own. When I think about my patients, I know there's a small group at the top with incredible will and determination who will navigate the system and do a fabulous job of improving their family's lives. And at the other end, there's a group that's going to have great challenges to prevent imperfect outcomes. So what I'm asking you to consider is this very large group in the middle, the bulk of the population, that can benefit from full access to contraception. And this is where that can make a big difference. By covering the cost of these highly effective methods of contraception, which cost about $500 a person, we can allow people to determine when is the best time to go to their families and allow them to optimize their education, completion, economic advancement, and have the families they want and plan for. And now I can hand things over to my colleague, Dr. Jessica Sanders, who will discuss the details and the data supporting improved Medicaid access to contraception.
Dr. Shaw, we have a question. I believe that will be
okay.
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 Hi, welcome. Hey, Dr. Sanders. Thank you. So my name is Jessica Sanders, and I have a PhD in public health, and I'm the director of the Family Planning Research Center at the University of Utah. So we're here, and Dr. Black discussed the shed some light on the research that we're doing, the research that's with them, and other locations that could demonstrate the need for standard family coverage. So just some historical evidence about federally funded family planning programs. We know that when we've been in the 1950s and 70s, when there were first federally funded family planning programs, that children that came after this were 15% less likely to live in households receiving public assistance, 4% less likely to live in single-parent households, 5% less likely to live in poverty. And by the 1970s, women who were below the federal poverty line in counties with publicly funded family planning services were 20% more likely to have ever used some type of contraception. So we know that when barriers were removed to accessing contraceptive methods, that people would use that. And we know that delaying parenthood, even for a year or two for many people, can allow soon-to-be parents to get more education, work experience, job training, and increase overall lifetime earnings. So that was seen in the 1950s and 70s. And that was with the kind of popularity of the birth control pill. In Utah, we know that the women's individual women's year-round full-time annual earnings is significantly lower than that of men's. And female households with children under 5 are more likely to live in poverty. So contraception is a basic pocketbook issue for many of these women and families. And a woman's ability to access affordable contraception not only impacts her family's overall economic security, but it impacts the day-to-day cost of living. So the average woman pays between $15 and $50 out of pocket in co-pays or for birth control pills, which comes to about $600 out of pocket each year. Other methods of contraception, such as IUDs or implants, if that is brought up, can cost hundreds of dollars in co-pays and out of pocket expenses. And in tough economic times, this money really, a lot of women need this to go for bills and groceries and gas. And so contraception is essential for working moms. It allows the Utah women to support their families. We know that access to family planning services can increase earning potential over time. And so the gender wage gap actually shrank about 10% in the 80s and 30% in the 90s, in part due to increased access to contraception. And the fact that young women who used birth control pills in the 60s ended up earning about 8% more by the age of 50 than their peers who did not have access to contraception. And these gains in earnings have increased dramatically over time, as well as women's ability to contribute to their family income and strengthen overall community economic security.
Dr. Sanders, just one thing, coming back to the previous slide.
Absolutely.
The difference between the 51% and the 73%, because it looks like they're both mothers with children.
So,
I'm sorry, the 51 includes under 6.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
Sorry, thank you.
So we also know that women on average spend about 5 years either pregnant or trying to become pregnant, and 30 years trying to avoid a pregnancy. It's a significant amount of time. It's not just like a point in my healthcare needs. This is something that is over, long over your lifespan, and people need different methods at different times of their lives, and that's something that this legislation can really support, is people's ability to access the method that's best for them at the point in their lives where they need it most. So, and as you know, parental data is largely available for non-pregnant childless adults. And so one of the changes we've seen from the data that Dr. Shirai suggested earlier about the birth control pill and where we are currently is there's an increased popularity of IUDs in advance, which are the most expensive up front, but overall it's become cost effective the last about 2 years. But they're 20 times more effective than the birth control pill. And many women in our community and our state have shown that they really like these methods, that they're acceptable, that they're satisfied with them, moving forward, and that they want them. So the program that we implemented, the HERS-Following program, shows us that when you removed out cost barriers and made these methods accessible and took cost out of women's decision of what types of contraception they wanted to use, they chose these methods largely. So one of the handouts that I gave you has a two-folded, and there's a demonstration from Colorado and a demonstration from Iowa. So one of the things that we saw in Colorado when getting increased access to contraceptive services was Medicaid awarded $79 million in expenditures over 5 years. Their high-risk births declined by 24%, and abortion rates fell almost by a third in 15 to 19-year-olds. So these are a very vulnerable population, and 18% among 20 to 24-year-olds. And so these are folks that are able to continue their education and get jobs that really build for their investment in the future. And they also saw an infant enrollment and WIC decline in the first few years off, so by a quarter. So these are some significant downstream impacts of expanding access. And similarly, both were demonstrated in Iowa when they expanded family planning coverage to 300% federal poverty. Iowa saw net savings of over $200 million in 9 years. So these are demonstrated cost-effective programs and budget neutral. But really, these impacts are much broader. These numbers are really just for birth costs and the first year of life. So when you're thinking about increased training, increased education, what that can do for women and families, the impact savings are much larger. So Utah is currently around 7 states without expanded family planning coverage. Just kind of a low-hanging fruit that's been demonstrated, this maximizing the flexibility of their settled program as it exists to really improve the health of our community. And as Representative Ford mentioned, there's an income age eligibility that services qualify for a 90% federal match. And then there are these improved birth outcomes and reduced reductions in abortions that can be seen within the first year and definitely within the first 3 years, which is what this program is designed to look at as a pilot program and to be evaluated. So extended coverage to 8,000 new homes could prevent 2,990 unplanned births covered by Medicaid, and about 680 abortions. And so these are numbers based on what was in the governor's budget last year about how many people they thought would access these programs. And so we see about $9 million net savings for the state with those individuals that also have this program. So it's a taxpayer and state budgetary one as well. Programs have demonstrated about $7 a day for every $1 spent on family planning services and the budget neutrality of the state after 2 years. And so we also have data that show that families win, increased post-secondary education, improved employment rates, increased earnings, more enduring marriages, and this idea that this can really break the cycle of intergenerational poverty for many families and women and children. So we also have a lot of stories from the folks that have accessed these programs, and this is one that I thought was really important to share. So this one was that I have 2 kids, a 9-year-old and a 5-month-old. I'm a single mother looking for employment with no vehicle and no help with babysitting. It would definitely make things harder for my kids if I wasn't able to access contraceptive services. So that's what I have for you. I would love to open up and do all the questions or comments.
that your conclusive presentation, right?
Yes.
Great. We do have some lights on. We'll go first to Senator Henderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few technical questions. So these are women who do not qualify currently for Medicaid, but if they were to become pregnant, would then qualify for Medicaid. Okay. Second, this talks about 15-year-old to 19-year-old young women. So I just describe the process there for a teenage girl who wants access to contraception.
So I think with respect to this waiver, it really, if they're still a child, they already would be on Medicaid. So that those numbers were the ones that were studied in that particular state. But with respect to this waiver, it wouldn't affect any children, because if you're a child, so if they are being 17 years old, you're already on Medicaid, so this really wouldn't have anything to do with it.
If they're below that poverty?
That's right.
Okay. So it's really 18 and up that this program would?
That's right.
Okay. So, and I guess last question, since I have you there, can I work? This was in the governor's budget last year. I'm not on social services appropriations anymore. Was there talk about this last year? What happened?
So this was talked about. It was talked about favorably. It ranked in the middle of the pack, just not high enough to make the cut for funding. The difficult dynamic in social services appropriations every year is that there's 5 houses burning down. That if you don't do this, this minute, this day, you're going to be sued by the fill in blank because we're not providing a service or something else is completely falling apart. And so we struggle to meet the emergencies every year, but at some point you have to prioritize something that can make your situation better in the long run, even if it isn't an emergency right this minute this year.
And you mentioned you don't have fiscal note debt. But do you have any idea?
So I anticipate it will be similar to the fiscal note last year, which was around $1 million.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Commissioner Wallace, or Vice President Wallace? Thank you. Thank you. And this is, I guess, a different curiosity from my own personal experience. I'm wondering about, are there inherent risks for using IUD and also implants, which I had a pulmonary embolism caused by the birth control I was on. I was wondering if there was any significant amount of cost with risks that come with using those contraceptives and if they have any impact significantly at all in the savings or the cost of using them.
That's a great question. And we have so much data on the safety and efficacy of these methods. There's two things. First of all, when you offer all methods of contraception, these most effective methods end up being the ones that people are most likely to continue for the longest period. Mm-hmm. And then the second is, they're also for all of the women who have medical complexities coming into the use of contraception, these are the methods that are the safest. They have the fewest adverse effects. So nothing is perfect. I think we can all appreciate that. But these are the things that we know are the safest, have the fewest side effects, and are most likely to be continued. And one of the methods, the hormonal IUD, has this really nice side effect that people like, and it essentially eliminates or really reduces your menstrual bleeding. And that's one of the reasons that it's the most, in this group of most effective methods, it's the number one choice.
Following up with Commissioner Wallace's question, would it be fair to assume that the Colorado and Iowa studies, when they talk about cost savings, they would have included any of those additional costs associated with those different levels of contraception?
Right. The complications, like you mentioned, with birth control pills, they're rare, but they can be very serious. And the cost savings in those measures were really focused on the activities related to prevention of unintended pregnancies and prenatal care and delivery.
So all of the risks, which are real, which need to be measured, do need to be stacked up against just the risks from pregnancy itself, which also with blood clots and bleeding, the terrible thing that go wrong sometimes, are the kinds of things that you have to weigh in the balance. In the bill that I'm proposing, it's proposed as a, right now, as a 4-year pilot. And in my mind, that's really a 3-year pilot, because you'll have to do the study to decide if you're going to continue it, you know, before you get to the very end of it. So it is for 4 years. You would be studying and reporting on it after the 3rd year to decide how it has turned out, what savings, if any, there have been, to balance it before you decide to make it permanent. But the request is that the Department of Health will retain a group to study all of those things to balance them out, so we'll be able to have our own data and not only data from Colorado or Iowa regarding their savings.
And we've got a ramp in, you know, on this group from Salt Lake County that we've already identified and are following. So we'll have preliminary to what would be and that's a great point, though. Essentially, you know, the complication rate for any method of contraception is lower than it is for pregnancy.
Thank you. That's
just one thing. Thank you.
Who partnered with you on this bill last year? Did you get someone else?
So last year, I didn't run a bill last year. It was just another budget request.
Okay. But this year, you're going to run a bill?
Yes.
And do you have someone who else would you have to have some?
I don't have a Senate sponsor yet.
And are you looking at a female sponsor?
Yes.
With you.
The short answer is I haven't gotten that far yet.
Okay.
We've worked really hard to talk with people on that.
Certainly consider.
Sure.
That's what I'll consider. Thank you. So all of your great advice here. Well spoken, I hope. Commissioner Moriarty, do you have a question?
Okay, Senator Henderson.
Okay, thank you.
So I want to follow up on this cost issue. If there were a complication coming from the use of contraceptives that were paid for by the state, would the state be on the hook for that? Or is that, because they don't have Medicaid, right? They either have whatever they have or nothing at all, I guess, or, you know, just depending on, would those be state costs and should they be?
So, if a service is defined as a family planning service, then it would be covered by this waiver. And so, if there was, my understanding of it is that if there was a complication that was still clearly part of that family planning services, then it would still be considered under this waiver. If something more complicated later on happened, I don't know that it would be.
That's a small proportion relative to the expenses related to pregnancy, even if every single pregnancy was without complication, which obviously could never happen.
So, for example, let's say an IUD was, and it was unusually painful, and so they had to come back in to have it removed or something else. Then that is still part of family planning services, so it would still be covered under this waiver.
Okay. That was just my question, that it may not be a terrible expense for the state, but it could potentially be one to the individual, so I just was wondering about that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We had mentioned the cost, potential costs associated with this as barriers to passage, as well as medical complications. Is there anything else that has come up in opposition to this work, which seems quite reasonable? But are there other arguments against doing this that we should know about?
I see those as the two biggest barriers to it. I think there was a time, 20 or 30 years ago, when a larger number of people felt that birth control itself was perhaps suspect. And maybe that was a reason to not want to have this. But I think we're not a few years, but a few decades past where the average person in our Utah population feels that way. And I think as testament to that, I would say if every state across the deep red South, Republican, ruby red South, has already implemented this, we can figure out a way to implement this.
Thank you.
Okay.
seeing no further questions from the committee, are there any members of the public who would like to make a comment related to this issue? Seeing none, we will look forward to seeing the language of your bill, and we will have another meeting before the legislative session begins, where we would love to actually have you circle back with us, and we would take some action as a committee. We take a vote of support for but anyway, so we'll circle back with you and invite you to visit us again. And Commissioner Burke,
we've handled it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. We'll go to our next item on the agenda. Welcome, IWCA. Youth and Maternal Mental Health White Paper. Thank you for having us. My name is Erin Jefferson. I'm the policy director with the LADBCA. I'm with Jackie Mandel with Rachel Street Petroleum here, and we'll get our presentation up for you. And we'll definitely email it as well. Thank you. We are here actually on behalf of what's called the Utah Maternal Mental Health Collaborative. This is a group of folks who started basically a grassroots collaboration a few years ago when we recognized that maternal mental health issues, kind of the name that we often use now around postpartum depression and related issues, were a significant issue in Utah, and we don't have the resources that we need to really respond to moms and families well. So over the past 6 to 8 months, that collaborative under our direction has formed a policy subcommittee, and we've been looking at what it would take to create system-wide, statewide change around this issue. So we've had a lot of folks who are sitting behind me who are real experts in terms of healthcare providers, from pediatricians to family physicians, OBGYNs, mental health care providers, as well as folks who've been impacted by this issue, Department of Health, Department of Human Services. We've really tried to take a collaborative systems approach to looking at what's going on around these issues in Utah, where are our biggest wins so far, where are our challenges, and what can we do moving forward. So I encourage you to look at the collaborative website if you want to learn more about them, because there's a lot of great folks still working on this issue. So to back up a little bit, just in terms of what we're talking about when we're talking about maternal mental health, we're looking at a range of conditions from pregnancy through the first year after childbirth. Some folks, when they're talking about this, even include pre-conception. So perinatal depression is one of the words that you'll often hear, meaning kind of all of the issues surrounding pregnancy and the first year after giving birth. It can really range from depression and anxiety to postpartum psychosis. But what we're not talking about are what, you know, people often refer to as the baby blues. That affects up to 80% of women after giving birth. But that's really not what we're talking about. That often lasts a couple of weeks, maybe a little bit longer. But what we're talking about are more serious mental health concerns that can last for that whole period, maybe even longer than that first year, but definitely more than the 2 weeks is kind of the definition that we're using. We just wanted to give you kind of some of the terms that you might hear. People do use these terms in very umbrella-like ways. So postpartum depression is still often what we hear, even though that clinically it's only described a certain set of conditions. You'll often hear perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. We often use perinatal depression or maternal mental health concern, but it's kind of the terms that we'll use as we're talking about this issue today, just to give you a little bit of that background as the field develops and some of the things you might hear. And I think Jesse is going to talk about that.
And so I'm Jesse Mandel. I'm the voices for Utah Children. I'm sorry, I have a cold today, so I'm a little raspier than usual. But one of the reasons we're particularly interested and concerned about this issue is not only the impact on the mother, but also the impact on the whole family and the child's development. And I think that's something that often you don't talk about when you talk about maternal depression, which is the impact on the whole family. So the mother is, of course, at risk for many, many different things, including substance use, depression, even suicide. But it runs the gamut. You know, the mother's more isolated, and so as she's going through different conditions, this impacts her bonding with the child. And we see that maternal depression can not only inhibit healthy bonding between mom and baby, but it can really impact the child's development. And so they can be missing those developmental milestones. They can have some social emotional development challenges, behavioral problems, and as you learn more about the brain and the brain development develops during this incredibly crucial phase in the baby and his life, we know that the relationship with the mother is a huge critical component. And so if they're not getting healthy attachment from the mother, then the child will have a hard time developing. And not only that, but it can cause conflicts with the whole family. Of course, if the mother is withdrawn, more isolated, then you feed the whole family. And if there's other children, they too can suffer, and relationships can suffer. But I think just on the development piece, it's important to emphasize that the mother, especially in the first 3 months, the fourth trimester, that's really the infant's whole world in a lot of ways. And so when the mother is going through something, the child will be affected. But it's still largely a silent issue. And sorry for maybe to quote them. But it is still largely a silent issue that mom's not talking about, that we're not talking about. And so this is a quote from the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, which we'll talk about in a minute, but I'll just read it to you. I have now had 3 pregnancies and 3 babies. It is a little upsetting to me that there isn't enough follow-up care or discussion with the mothers regarding postpartum depression here in Utah. I have never filled out a survey or been asked about my thoughts and well-being after having a baby. It is difficult, embarrassing, and honestly confusing for mothers and all the hormones and emotions after having a baby. It is hard to bring that yourself, and many women think they have to just deal with the way they're feeling. Moms are exhausted and doing so much for their babies and families. It would be nice if someone was concerned and looking out for mom every once in a while. A lot of women like myself don't even know they have PPD. Please help us, moms. So I think that just applies to you. The way that moms are often told, oh, you're fine, baby blues, we'll get over it, and we don't talk about it as a larger condition.
So when we do take the issue more seriously, we see that it is the number one complication of childbearing. So it's often think about things like low birth weight, preterm birth, gestational diabetes, issues like that, when actually this impacts more women and families than those issues. Estimates are 1 in 7 in the U.S. I should note, as Jesse was just referencing, this is still such a silenced, kind of in the dark issue that I think we really need to look at this as estimates and assume that these are conditions that are very often underdiagnosed and underreported in our prevalence data. So with the highest birth rate in the nation, we are estimating that over 7,000 childbearing women in Utah per year are experiencing these concerns. So Jesse read that quote from the PRAMS data. So PRAMS is the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, which is really the primary only kind of statewide data system that we have right now to look at this issue, and it's pretty limited. You'll see in the next slide that we have some work to do in terms of how we're collecting this data. But the data that we do have comes from randomly selected moms who have just given birth. It's given, I believe, in the hospital of the Department of Health this year, if you have more questions about that. And what we see, the most recent data is 14% of other non-Hispanic women, 13% of Hispanic women, and 12% of white women are reporting specifically postpartum depression symptoms. And so that survey asked them a few questions about what kind of mental health challenges they may have experienced before and during pregnancy, and we're happy to get you more data if you're interested in that. But that's those are the responses we found with the specifically postpartum depression. And again, we have the numbers there compared to other issues that we hear a lot more about. So with PRAM, we've been doing iterations of that in the state of Utah since 1999. These are self-reported, so you are just asking if you're experiencing these issues. There's no actual screening tool that's used, which we do have in order to assess someone beyond that kind of self-reported piece. And there's one of the questions both that the state, that each state can add to this system, but also limited questions around mental health that they're able to add. And again, it's a random selection of women, so we know that even our estimates on prevalence are pretty limited based on this research. So one of our top recommendations around that piece is to enhance that data collection system, and we have conversations with folks who are responsible for research and data within the Department of Health around what that might look like, and we're happy to talk in more detail later about that. But that's really the number one thing that we need in terms of research, is to figure out exactly how prevalent this is, and then really start to assess what's going on in the state in terms of response for and support for women and families. So public awareness is one of the aspects that we've looked at. These are just a few programs that I'm sure that you've heard about, or at least heard about some of them, that there's a little bit of public education that's happening around issues with healthy child development and that time period around the childbearing years, but there really isn't any kind of statewide coordinated campaign. And while sometimes we'll see some of these campaigns have a spot or two about maternal mental health issues, there isn't a real statewide campaign around that to reduce the stigma, which really does still exist for so many women and families, and educate them on what to look for, and then these issues do kind of surpass that baby blues condition. And one of the recommendations to explore that shared messaging across different agencies and making sure that folks are getting that accurate information and how they can get help. So screening and support is really kind of where the rubber meets the road. What we found in talking with providers and bringing together folks who provide peer support as well as clinical mental health services to these women and families is that we don't have systemic system-wide healthcare system-wide screening. That if you happen to get asked about whether you have experienced any of these systems, it's really left up to chance, and whether your own individual provider is educated on this issue and feels that it's important. We've heard a lot from people who are impacted by this issue and folks who provide mental health care around this that there's still even a stigma around physical health care providers that mental health care isn't as important. Of course, this is not across the board, but that this is one of the barriers to people getting screened and getting help. However, we also hear from providers that even when they do screen someone, there isn't a good statewide referral system. So they screen someone, they're in a busy clinic. What if you find out that this person is experiencing these issues? They don't know where to send them. There aren't enough mental health care providers. There isn't a good way to know even if there is someone in their area or whether they're qualified and whether that's someone that they can send this mom to. So it's kind of a chicken and egg situation where we need system-wide screening, but we also need someone in some place to send folks if we do screen a positive response. So we have really recommend widespread provider training and education, but also creating that referral system. Every day we hear about a new person who might be doing a support group or who may be in their clinic one day a week really focuses on these issues. There isn't a good database or a central place in the state to say, these are the folks who are trained in this issue in terms of the mental health care piece, and this is where you can find folks. This is where people can find peer support. The Utah Maternal Mental Health Collaborative, if you go on their website right now, you will see a list of providers. This is a volunteer-run collaborative that's just trying to compile resources when they hear about them, but there isn't any kind of institutionalized central location for this information. And then lastly, one of the things that's happening in other states and in Utah that really can help identify these moms and families who are struggling with this. Our program called Help Me Grow, which is run through 211, where folks can call. They just started doing postpartum depression screening that is evidence-based, and now they're facing funding cuts. So just when we started to have some kind of a statewide referral system, now we're unsure if that's going to be able to be maintained. Home visiting programs also facing significant funding cuts. That's another place where we're really seeing underserved populations, communities of color, women who are the most at risk and low income, able to have that help, that peer support come into their home and hopefully get them clinical support if they do kind of reach that level of need. And we're seeing funding cuts to that as well. And community health workers is another resource that can really be the first place that a lot of moms are getting this contact and having these questions asked. Because of that stigma piece, those folks can really kind of break through that and start to have those conversations with moms.
So we've also looked at the role of healthcare systems and insurance companies in maternal mental health. And kind of taking off the mouth of white men's other own screening, insurance companies and healthcare systems can play a huge role in incentivizing screening, and not just screening, but also the reporting and the data that we collect, including quality measures around the mother's health as well as the baby, so we could see outcomes and improvements over time. We don't have great mother and baby quality measures right now in the current system that we report. And also that the insurance companies and systems can really incentivize maternal mental health services. One way is by expanding case management and care coordination programs, and we're seeing some promising pilots, but of course there's a need to make that system-wide. And this is where women can especially have this women can really get the services from prenatal to postpartum and even moving in the pediatrician too. So we're making sure that all providers that are touching the mom and the baby are alerted to issues that the child could be showing and the mom. And also, of course, a gap in the system that we are seeing is the lack of services for underinsured and uninsured mothers. And as we were just discussing in the previous presentation, there's too many women that don't have access to health insurance. If you're pregnant, you give birth, then you lose your Medicaid coverage 50 days postpartum. And that's really when we start to see symptoms showing up for a mother. And so that's when the mother is cut off. And it's very hard to find a sliding scale or any kind of resources for uninsured or underinsured women. And the problem there is that in doing that, it's not only a disservice to the mother, it's a disservice to the child. And we really need to start seeing the health of the mother and the parents as integral to the health of the child and the whole family. In regard to our public policies and resources, I'm going to go through some of these and then Erin can jump in as well. We are seeing growing awareness of maternal mental health as an issue, and there was actually something pretty covered recently. The month of May, I think, was established as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month. So that was a terrific step in the right direction. But of course, there's limited funding and support, and also there's limited discussion about how maternal mental health connects to child's development. And so those are where we need to be broadening our networks and conversations. There's also a need for increased resources for centralizing information and resources. We talked about the Maternal Mental Health Collaborative website. That's been a great kind of spoke or hub for the many folks that we're seeing. But that's a volunteer run, and capacity is limited based on the capacity of volunteers. So there's a need to kind of centralize information and coordination across agencies and support across the state. In addition, there's also a need to make sure that the resources that can address, that can prevent, that are really upstream, like community health workers, home visiting programs, and peer support programs that can really meet the mother where she's at and help identify and treat conditions before they might escalate, that those programs are consistently funded and that we're not seeing dips and programs have to shut down. For example, the Nurse Family Partnership Program in Utah County recently closed. And that's just, you start to build up a program and then it has to shut, and that's we lose moms in that process, and that's a concern. So we need stable funding across the board. And then we need to continue on this idea of a statewide approach, a task force or commission to develop a plan across the state. So we're making sure that there's all the players that need to be there, all the stakeholders, and we're coordinating across agencies so that we're not hearing about this program over in this agency and this over here, making sure that they're speaking and talking together. And to that end, we need to really have a thorough assessment and conduct a resource needs assessment of what is happening at the state level and across the state in remote areas, in urban areas, where are people going for those services, and what kind of providers, including behavioral health care providers, pediatricians, OBGYN, what people, what resources people are tapping into and how they're talking to one another.
So really what we're here today to ask you for is your feedback, any questions or pieces of information that really feel like the most central and important to you. We are finalizing a white paper. What you just saw was kind of the 11 slide distilled version of about a 15-page paper that we are finalizing, again, with all of those collaborators, all those stakeholders at the table that have been working on that with us. But as we finalize that and start to have broader conversations, we're just looking for your feedback about what you've heard and about maybe what is the most impactful information or where you think the most momentum might be in terms of moving forward. I will say we don't have time in the paper or today to tell you about the many great things that are happening among individual providers in different clinics and around healthcare, just put mental health in their strategic plan, and maternal mental health is a really important focus of theirs. The U is doing some really great work to try to have more research. They just got a grant from the Department of Health to do a pilot project for telemental health services in rural parts of the state. So I don't want to kind of gloss over some of the really good work that's being done by folks who are in this room and not in this room because they're out doing most of the work. I think we're here to kind of provide a perspective of how do we move this beyond individual pilot projects and individual providers who care to really having a statewide system that responds to moms and families the way that they deserve. So that concludes our presentation.
Thank you. Let's go to some questions. We'll start with Senator Henderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation and for your work on this really long neglected issue. And it's such an overwhelming issue because as you say, there are just so many moving parts, and then on top of that, there's a lack of service providers. There's just a lack of resources, and it's hard to know as a policymaker what to do, what the next step should be. So I really appreciate some of your recommendations. The task force idea is I think, a good one, and we, especially in the Senate, tend to spur new task forces and things, but it's really difficult as lawmakers to dive deep into some of these issues to know what we need to be doing as a state and when it comes to potential legislation to get the ball rolling on some of these topics. And so I think that's probably a critical piece. And just bringing this topic up the last couple of years, it's gratifying to hear what you're saying about Intermountain and some of these other, in the University of Utah, really starting to take a look at this. And I think maybe the more we talk about it, the more maybe there might be some grassroots and just natural efforts by people. So that's good. But aside from just maybe a task force, what can we do or should we, do you have any ideas at the state of how we can increase the number of service providers? My sister is a certified nurse midwife. She delivers babies down in American Fork, American Hospital, and this is a huge problem. She tells me, and there's not a lot they can do. They can prescribe drugs, that they don't do the counseling and some of the other things that really a specialist needs to be doing. So what are some things that we can be doing as a state to encourage the specialty or the training or a certificate or something for healthcare providers to be able to have some
extra training in this area, either pediatricians or nurse midwives or OBGYNs?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not going to claim to have all the answers, but we are seeing more, the collaborative itself is providing more training, for instance, to Intermountain, because they've identified this as a priority. I think a couple of things that we didn't get into in this presentation would be around some kind of requirement in continuing education, some kind of statewide, whether it's through the Department of Health, I don't know, I don't have all of those details at the top of my head, but some kind of support for people to get that training. Right now it's happening by people who really care about this issue and are getting folks together. Again, I would say Intermountain and the University of Utah are both really putting some resources and attention behind it, but we know that doesn't impact everyone. So the continuing education piece is something that we talked about. The other piece I would say, and Jesse can speak better to this, is around the fact that even when we do have specialties and people who are really qualified and trained to do this, people can't afford to go to them. And I think that's an issue across mental health.
Or it takes 6 months to get an appointment.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's huge waiting lists. So I think having more discussions, I will say that's the one group that hasn't come to our table yet, is insurance companies and looking at that payer system piece of the issue, which is one of the reasons we like the task force, is in terms of having a little weight on getting folks to the table. But otherwise, I think there's a ton of momentum and attention in the provider community among moms and families who are seeing this as a need. And there's probably people who can speak more eloquently than I to answer your question about how we get more of those folks trained. But I think a lot of it comes down to funding and resources.
And also, I would add that doing sort of a statewide assessment is really important too, because sometimes you do hear, oh, I'm over here and I'm doing, but no one's coming to do support groups that I'm running, or exactly. And so how to specialize that information, like how we can map what's happening, where Americans can really kind of guide and identify the gaps, and then make sure that there's a centralized place that people know about. And so I think, I think that's another piece that just, not that there's definitely a lack of providers, especially in certain areas, but I think there's more happening and people are just not getting connected. So I think we need to do that sort of statewide resource mapping and assessment as well.
Yeah, as a family founding state, we can definitely do better.
Yeah.
Thank you. Commissioner Leonardi.
I'm sorry, thank you. Thank you for your work. Oh my gosh. So let me go back to
the gathering, how you get this information from these moms. You were saying that sometimes they'll come up to the hospital and talk to them. How did they? Can you speak on that? Maybe it was just too much information for me. But
okay, I'm going to jump in and then Randy can jump in. So I think Rand has actually mailed out. So that's the one survey that's the
It's mailed. There's
about 6 weeks.
There's a hard copy.
Three.
Okay.
3 months.
Okay. It's like a questionnaire that's mailed to the mom, and it's like one more piece of mail she has to open when she's been up all night. Okay, now just to make sure, I'm not into. Okay, go ahead. Now it's down. This is visualizing it. And that's it.
Well, okay. It depends on her identifying those symptoms and obviously responding to
the patient.
Okay, so. Okay, yeah, tell me what you need to say. So I'm old, and I just took a Google Maps class and thought, and as you're going through your presentation, I'm thinking, why can't you have an app that you download on your phone for the mother? You're in the office waiting for their appointment, and there's a song that says, please go to this and download your app and answer these questions. And when you answer them, then you click on this little button, and the little button is going to tell you the resources that you're working on, whether they can afford them, whether they can't, whatever. And then you could take that test. I mean, I don't know if you know that you have postpartum depression, maybe you'll have to finish nursing, or if you don't nurse, or if whatever, or if your husband leaves you after the first year. I mean, how do you know these things? Excuse me. I mean, I know it's been a long time that I can remember. But I just was thinking, oh my golly. And I didn't want to had pneumonia shot, and they gave me this piece of paper to fill out before I could get my pneumonia shot. And I thought, really? Walgreens? Why did you just send it? Let you tell me on here that it's time for me to come in for my flu shot. Everything is now done electronically. And these 20-year-olds to 40-year-olds are a lot healthier than the 70-year-old person right here. But I just, and then you really get a job because I just think that's key. Because our children, you say, you take care of the mother, you take care of the family. I believe it. Thank you. Sorry to rant, but I was just visualizing an app.
Another something we talked about, not specifically that idea, but those are the kinds of conversations we've been having around improved data collection. Other states have seen apps and other things in terms of also getting moms some more peer support, connecting them to other folks. So I would say yes, those are all ideas in the hopper in terms of where we would want to commit some resources. And I heard you with the center and why can't we do this at welfare visits? That's another thing we talk about all the time. In terms of Medicaid, there actually is, even once a mom is no longer on Medicaid after she's given birth, we just discovered that providers can use a particular billing code to do a screening with mom through their child's Medicaid ID number, but the reimbursement rate is $2 and something or $3 and something. And providers don't even know they can do that, let alone what they do know. That's not much of an incentive to do it, yeah. But the other issue that we hear from, and Dr. Bill Costa's behind me, he and other amazing pediatricians were doing these screenings and trying to refer folks to the right services, but we have other pediatricians who, the mom's not the patient, that's kind of their concern, and they don't have the training or the resources to provide that. So those are all conversations that we've been having in terms of where we need to move.
So tell me why we need to include pediatricians in the most contact place. Yeah, you get off, you know, after your 60th visit, you're done going to regular doctor's visits, and so your interaction with the healthcare provider is through your child's provider.
Great. Commissioner Wallace?
My question is very quick. I'm just wondering, I know that this is a problem everywhere. I mean, a global issue. I'm sure that it's not just the United States, but are there states in the U.S. that have a system that we can model after that's started or is working? So that's my question.
No, it's not. Some have done the pieces around what we recommended in terms of a statewide assessment, getting all stakeholders to the table because it is overwhelming. There's a lot of moving parts. California, Maryland, Oregon are the ones that we've looked at the most. Massachusetts, I think, just put out a white paper about this. So they're kind of all maybe a little bit further ahead, but really still assessing the issue and how we can look at all of those different moving parts because there's a lot of chickens and eggs to figure out what comes first, second, and third. So those are the things that we've really been looking at in terms of even where do we start with assessment. And again, there might be other folks who provide you with more, but that's who we've been looking at this point.
Yeah, and I'd say Oregon, like, they created a sort of a, they call it Blue Ribbon task force, basically, to look at the issue, and then, like, I feel, I think, yeah, those are the, you know, Oregon off in junction with the top in Massachusetts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Goldholder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I keep thinking about the conversation that we just had about unintended pregnancy and what we know about the relationship, or don't know, about the relationship between unintended pregnancy and maternal mental health. So from a policy perspective, as we look at moving pieces, I think it's really important for us to think about the integration of the pieces so that if we know, for example, that there is a correlation or a relationship, and you do know that, that we take that into account when we are talking about legislation regarding unintended pregnancy and family planning coverage. Because by making those connections and integrating the arguments, I think that we can be stronger in our policy and have a better impact on women and on their families.
Right. I mean, we have all been in discussion, I totally agree, and there is you are at an increased risk for maternal mental health challenges if you have an unintended pregnancy. That's what we see from the FRAM data. So we know there's a connection there. Yeah. And so
we will be calling that out when it comes up this session.
And I think a lot of it is, you know, unintended pregnancy is one area. There's other risk factors and making connections that people might not think, as you said, are maternal mental health policies, but actually there is a direct connection. And that's why we kind of raise home visiting programs as well, and community health workers, those sort of lay or peer support, like community health workers or peer support programs that also can play a role in preventing postpartum depression. And so, yeah, absolutely unintended pregnancies, there's a, you're at a higher risk.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion from the committee, any members of your illustrious public like to speak? Come up and make a comment or anything that's on this you would like to point out. Yeah, come on up, Dr. Clausel.
Thanks for your time. I'm Dr. Bill Cox, I'm a pediatrician. I kind of want to put a child oriented spin on this a little bit. Everything we do to help a young mother is going to help that child. And when you think about 51,000 births, 7,000 of these mothers are depressed. Only 1,000 of them get any kind of therapy, any treatment. And often that's as simple as just an antidepressant, not counseling, not full-blown therapy. So we've got an awful lot of moms out there who are depressed, and they think, well, most of them survive it. Most of them get through it. Most of them, if it doesn't fit, it gets you stronger. And so the mother does survive, but the child can be permanently harmed. Research data shows that a child who's neglected, just a mom who doesn't play with them, doesn't talk to them, you know, gives them that 30-minute workout, just a mom who doesn't respond to the child, that neglect is as severe an insult to that child's brain as if that child was physically or sexually abused. So we're talking about big risk, lots of numbers, big damage. And one other point to consider is that this affects the child's brain. We kind of try to separate mental health from physical health, but there are physically changes, obvious changes on MRI scans of a child who's neglected. And this is kind of one of the main reasons for neglect. So we really need, this is a crisis, we need to move on this somehow. And again, there's an awful lot of moving parts in this. Pediatricians are reluctant to do this again because they don't see the mom as our patient, but our patient depends totally on that mom. And so a few of us have expanded our role to try to include the mother, but it's difficult because we're not praying for this either. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation and the work of all the folks that are on your team here doing this. This is, as has been stated, very, very important, and I think we'll look forward to continuing to hear what you come up with in your conversations in the meetings about ways that we as a commission can support you and certainly legislators as well if there's something we can do if we get closer to the session. So thank you very much. We will go to our subcommittee updates. Is there someone from the communications and research subcommittee here who would like to present?
Ray.
Commissioner Wallace.
My update is we did not have a meeting, so we
did not. But thanks for letting me tell you.
All right. So that's for communication.
Yeah, right?
For communication.
And I don't see anyone from the research.
No.
Okay. And let's see. Tim Henderson, I missed that last meeting on the. I'm going to report back on the information I know on public policy. And with Senator Henderson and I both missing the meeting that Representative Shadley Cox and some others had related to public policy, there's I think we're facing a legislative session where we could have some exciting pieces of legislation coming forward in this arena, dealing with education, job skills and training, workplace issues, wage and financial resource development, as well as family support for women. Really all kind of focused on ways to enhance family economic prosperity and opportunities. So this is not a formal suite of legislation, but there are numerous pieces that are coming forward on issues related to workplace discrimination, gender wage gap, unpaid family leave, child care, family planning, which we heard today, potentially something on maternal mental health, the EITC, living wage, breastfeeding issues, and probably many more that we're not aware of. We're in the midst of sort of trying to gather our arms around legislation that fits in that realm of supporting family economic prosperity, bringing Utah data to the conversation so we really understand where we're headed with all of these issues, and discussing how the state can enhance and support what's working and figure out how the state can remove barriers for women to succeed, women and families to succeed. So that's sort of our goal. We know that there will be, as I said, a slate of legislation that comes out from numerous sponsors in both the House and the Senate, and when we have our next meeting, hopefully we'll be in a position where we can actually see some language on some of those bills. Anything to add, Senator? Okay. Let's go to planning our next meeting. Shelley, what is our date for our next?
It will be... It's December 5th.
I was really hoping you would not say December because then that just seems so close to many things that are coming out for December and exciting times. So it looks like on December 5th at 10 o'clock, right?
Yes.
And will that be our last meeting before the legislative session? Okay, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I heard that little groan over there.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you. I just really hope this year that we can really get behind the Senator's bills. I know that in my world, the gentlemen that I work with are always asking me, what are you passionate about? What are you following? And I just really want us to really buckle down, and because we have a lot of wisdom in this room, and I just think we should really support some of these bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Keep that passion alive until December 5th and on to January. The March 5th, here we go.
Yeah,
we're on the march until March 5th. I agree. There's some exciting things afoot, and these are important issues, and I couldn't be more optimistic and more appreciative of all the work that's being done by so many people on these issues. So, we will anticipate hearing specific legislation. So, Aaron and your team, if you have something by then, that would be great. We'd love to hear back from you on the Representative Ward issue. Commissioner Bones.
Thank you. I was just wondering, I help out with the LGP Commission, and what we do is we send out notice, we just give to all legislators and stakeholders that if they do have legislation that they would like the Commission to consider, that they'll have the next meeting to say, they need to have the written legislation in by a certain date. And I don't know if there's commissioners interested in doing something like that as well, especially if we really do want to vote and get behind and support some legislation.
That is a really great reminder. We tried to do that last year, and I'm not sure we gave enough notice. So, yeah, great reminder. We'll do that. We'll get that out in the next, Shelley, I'm asking you with this. Kathy, could you send Shelley sort of the language of what the IGP sends out, and then create something, and co-chair Shadow Talk and I will send that out to our colleagues in the House and Senate. And
go ahead. I think someone called it. And then I know we have a meeting in December, but it might be better if we do it January. So there's more time for the draft and attorneys to get some language completed for us to review and then we can actually take action. Just a suggestion. I don't know.
No, I think that is a good point. We are a body that works on deadlines, and the reality is we will be pushed back to January because that's sort of how life goes.
I just wanted to bring up one other issue that, policy-wise, I don't know if you've been following the discussions that the Revenue Taxation and our committee has been having about the food tax.
Mm-hmm.
There have been efforts for the food tax lowered, to raise it back up again. I've been opposed to those efforts and fighting those efforts on my end. Now there are efforts underway to completely eliminate it. Representative Quinn has opened the bill file to at least eliminate the state portion of it. So anyway, that's on the radar, so something to watch that this community may be interested in keeping that on.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the reminder. What do we think? The discussion, I think Kathy makes a good point about having this in January. How does everyone feel about that? I mean, it needs an additional meeting, but realistically,
so would that mean that we meet just before the legislative session and then one time during the legislative session?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good idea.
Okay. Yeah. So let's shall we make a determination, or should we just open our calendars right now? We typically meet on the first Tuesday. But that would be January 2nd. What would either the 9th or the 16th look like? With realizing that we are... Yeah.
Is it Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
That would be the day before the 6th. Yeah,
that's
the 15th.
Maybe we should do the
8th.
Just stay away from
it?
Or
9th, stay away. Okay. January 9th, the second Tuesday.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So let's get that out as well for our commissioners, and then we'll create an email and send out an initial invitation to legislators now, and then sort of follow up, and it may require several follow-ups. Just knowing that.
Do you want to keep the December meeting or just move it to
January? Yeah, let's keep the December meeting.
And then schedule one in January.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Any last items from anyone? All right, seeing none, we'll entertain one final motion. Thank you, Senator Henderson. Motion to adjourn. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. We are adjourned.